Innovation is a word we hear often, but not always with specifics about how to innovate. We've got a thought leader coming up, Chris Price. He's director of New Slang Media, a consulting firm that lives at the intersection of broadcasting and webcasting. He believes that innovation is a discipline, and here to discuss that, please welcome Chris Price.
Thank you, Kurt. Thrilled to be here today. Mainly because Rain and I operate in very similar spaces. I describe what I do as music strategy, where broadcast and webcast collide, which is partly a product of my CV, having done head of music type jobs for Radio 1, MTV, Last FM, BT Music, and others over the years. But mostly it's just I get a real thrill about working in the sort of increasingly narrow space between terrestrial radio and streaming services, working with clients on both sides, helping to build audience through content, curation, and creativity. And it was the third of those three C's, creativity, that I want to talk to you about today, because one of the things that's common to every single one of my clients on both sides of broadcast and webcast is really the need to sort of stay on the top at the top of their game creatively. So, you know, whether you're a content creator, dreaming up new program ideas or show features for your radio station, whether you're a curator faced with the challenge of coming up with great playlist ideas day in, day out, or whether you're in the business of innovating completely new products, creativity and innovation is what's going to help you win. So I've given my presentation the slightly paradoxical title, I guess, The Discipline of Innovation, because I want over the next sort of 15 minutes or so to really disavow you of any sense that you might have that creativity is just something that strikes in a kind of eureka moment, that just strikes certain types of people at certain times. Innovation and creativity can be learned and it can be planned for. First, I want to talk about your brain, which you don't need me to tell you is a pretty amazing piece of kit up there in your head. The brain is a self-organizing mechanism. So unlike when you store files on a computer, selecting folders and subfolders to put things in, the brain automatically sorts all of the data that it takes in without you having to think about it. You've probably noticed not noticing that. So it's like a huge filing system. And new information is digested and stored in an easily retrievable way. So when new data comes in, the brain just stores, selects a place to store that information by looking for similarities with whatever's already on file. Now, the upside to all of this is that you don't have to tackle everything from first principles every single day. You don't have to figure out where your socks go every morning, for example. The downside to it is that all of that effortless classification that your brain is doing all day long actually stifles creativity. And over the course of our lives and over the course of millions of years of human evolution, this classification has led to very kind of entrenched ways of thinking, or what is sometimes referred to as rivers of thinking. And this idea of rivers of thinking was first coined by Edward de Bono, whom many of you, I'm sure, will know as the sort of godfather of corporate creativity. And he visualized data entering the brain like rain falling on a mountain. So the rain falls on the top of the mountain, and as it does so, it starts to form streams, which, as more and more information flows in, they get deeper and deeper, and as they reach the bottom, they start to form rivers. And it's getting stuck in these rivers that really sort of stifles our creativity every day. So you need some help jumping out of them and across them. By the way, the guy on the left there, jumping over the river with the excellent calves, that's me. Just to show you the lengths I go to put these presentations together. So you need some help jumping across your rivers. And this is what Edward de Bono calls lateral thinking. By the way, comedians do this naturally. According to some research by the Stanford Research Institute, one of the things that makes comedians funny is that they have this sort of almost preternatural ability to make these connections across rivers, almost kind of creating synapses in their brain that don't exist in everybody else's. So, when Woody Allen says, Not only is there no God, but have you tried getting a plumber in Manhattan on a Sunday? What he's doing there is he's making a connection between these two rivers, between the sort of the banalities of everyday life and the kind of and the metaphysical, I guess. So that's why that's funny. there are numerous techniques for sort of jumping across rivers. Four of the most common are sometimes referred to as the four R's, related worlds, revolution, re-expression, and random links. I've only got time to cover a couple of them today. So let's just have a quick look at how these have been deployed in the world of FMCGs, and then later on I'll come to show you how I've sort of applied them to music strategy over the years with radio and TV and streaming services. So related worlds, this is the first of our sort of creative techniques. This is all about harnessing the experience of other people facing the same challenge. So imagine you're a product developer for Mum's deodorant, and your challenge is to innovate innovative solution to wasteful aerosols that get deodorant pretty much everywhere except on your underarms. So you look around at other people or products or organizations that are engaged in the business of spreading liquid evenly across a surface. And you might look at ballpoint pens and take that as your inspiration. And yes, that was indeed the inspiration for Mum's invention of roll-on deodorant all the way back in 1952. So the second of our creative techniques, revolution, this is all about sort of deliberately breaking the rules and challenging assumptions. So perhaps you're developing new types of shampoo for Johnson & Johnson. And you ask yourself, what are the rules of shampoo and how might we break them? Well, shampoo tends to be liquid. Does it have to be a liquid? Could it come in a solid or a mousse or a cream? Shampoo usually comes in a plastic bottle. Does it have to? Could it come in capsules or wrapped up in fabric or in a beautiful glass bottle? It's normally used with water. Does it have to be used with water? Could it be used dry or sprayed on? So you're probably noticing that these are some of the actual kind of innovations in the world of shampoo and bath products. So that's just a couple of useful techniques to help you jump rivers. As I say, there are tons more that I use with clients in all different areas. But ideas in themselves are really only half the story. Modern business thinking it very well understands the importance of innovation and creativity, how it can create and sustain competitive advantage. But very few companies, and I think this is especially true of fast-moving media companies like radio stations and streaming services that are constantly having to be creative day in, day out, very few of them actually know how to make creativity work for them. Most of them think that it's just about having a brainstorm, having having out-of-the-box ideas. So somebody organizes a brainstorm and asks the immortal question, who's got an idea? Well, even if it were possible to sort of make a diary appointment for a moment of creative genius like that, there's still something very, very crucial missing from this picture. Because ideas are really just the engine for creativity. If you really, really want to have compelling ideas, then you have to get compelling insights. And insights, if you like, are what sort of start the creative engines running. So if you want to dream up new products, new programs, new playlists that are truly going to resonate with your listeners or your customers, it's absolutely essential that the creative process starts there with the customer. So audience insight is kind of the creative spark that will lead not just to new ideas, but to meaningful ideas. And that's just as true of music curation, the business that I'm involved in, as it is for shampoo. So what's insight? Okay, getting to the crux of it now. So the best description I've heard of insight is that it's a fundamental human truth connected to the creative challenge at hand. And you'll know that you've hit on an insight because it'll say something about your listeners' underlying feelings, motivations, needs, hopes, desires. It'll probably reveal something about their day-to-day lives. It's really important to note that insight is not data. It's not information. We heard an awful lot of data this morning from Les in the Spotify presentation. It's all fantastic data that will help better serve up those playlists or those songs. It's not going to help you have ideas in the first place. What you need for that is insight. So just to kind of flesh that out with an example, perhaps. I was recently doing some workshops with Mix Radio down in Bristol. They recently launched a new app and needed some help with their curation strategy. So I went down there and spent some time working with them, brainstorming some ideas around summer programming. So we went off into Bristol City Centre and did our insight gathering exercise. And we asked our respondents to just talk to us about the greatest summer of their entire lives, just to try and get some insight around this. And so I spoke to one lady, and I said to her, you know, what was the greatest summer of your life? And she said, well, I've had some fantastic summer holidays over the years. I've travelled all over the world. But if I really think about it, probably the best summer of my entire life was when I was about 15. I went on holiday youth hostelling with some friends of mine to the Isle of Wight. Isle of Wight, not really an insight. So I, you know, just dug a little deeper. It's all about kind of reading between the lines, I guess. So, you know, what was it that made that particular summer really, really special for you? And she said, well, I guess it was probably because it was the first time I'd been away without my parents, and there's this tremendous sense of freedom. And then straight away I knew that there was something here about this idea about a sense of freedom. It was an insight that we could then feed in as a creative stimulus to start innovating around, and start creating some ideas. So that's insight. How do you go about getting it? Well, I guess I've just given you a brief introduction to it. The first thing is to talk directly to your listeners. That might seem obvious. Every single creative challenge, every single creative process at Radio 1 and MTV and with clients that I work with now starts with an insight gathering process. And this tends to be the bit, when I introduce this with new clients, it tends to be the bit that elicits the most sort of teeth-sucking and eye-rolling, especially from senior people, by the way, who are usually spending tens of thousands of pounds on a research company or some kind of insight agency. Sack them immediately and just start talking directly to your customers in a very kind of quick and dirty way. Do it in the town centre of where your company is based, or take a train a few hours away and start talking directly to your customers. Don't look for an immediate solution to the brief, which is another way of saying don't ask your customers or your listeners to do your job for you. I'm reminded here of the probably apocryphal story of Henry Ford when he said that, if I asked my customers what they wanted, they'd probably tell me faster horses. So if you're dreaming up new ideas for summer programming, you're not going to find them by asking your audience for ideas about, you know, what summer programming they would like to hear. You're going to do it by encouraging storytelling, looking for real-life experience, engaging in a conversation, and opening up some of your own experience. So what I wanted to do now, that's how you gather insight. What I wanted to do now is just to give you a couple of examples of how I've used these techniques in this process overall over the years with some of my own program making. Most Punk was a program that I made, nearly 10 years ago now, with Zane Lowe at Radio 1. And as with all creative briefs at Radio 1 at the time, the process started with insight gathering. So myself and a colleague, we took ourselves off to Milton Keynes Shopping Centre one half term and spent a few hours talking to young people there about what they knew about punk. And I guess we expected to hear all of the usual stuff, like punks all sort of shouty bands and safety pins through the nose and spitting and, Mohican haircuts and bother boots, that kind of thing. Maybe some of the more enlightened people would know the music a bit. They might understand that punk is all about kind of breaking the rules and refusing to compromise. Actually, we just got completely blank faces. Most people knew absolutely nothing about punk music. They could barely name a single band. Let alone pontificate about the spirit of punk. So we returned to Radio 1. We were slightly demoralised, thinking that our insight gathering had been a bit of a failure, until we realised, actually, that the chief insight coming out of it was how poorly understood punk is by young people. So we needed to find a vehicle for our programme that was going to, if you like, embody those Reithian values that Rhys Hughes mentioned this morning of inform, educate and entertain. And so we came up with this idea of a list of the most punk people from all walks of life, not just music, but from fashion, literature, sport, comedy, film directing. And it was called Not Punk, Most Punk. Here's a quick taster of what it sounded like. I should let you know in a slightly BBC way that this clip features strong language from the start.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I thought you might like to know that in the spirit of punk rock, the following show includes what we also refer to as language. So if, like me, you're offended by such words and phrases as arse, bollocks, tit, wank, titwank, rotter, motherfucker, 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 twat, name's James Potter, and of course arse, then you might wish to turn over or fuck off.
Future, we've got a very first live performance coming up from Made in Vegas. All three boys will be taking a stab at a classic punk rock song in honor of some of their heroes. But right now we can get straight into the chart. We've mucked around long enough. We're heading into our first quarter of the first hour of the 4-hour extravaganza, Most Punk. It's important to point out across the top 20 throughout the night. It's not just about the music. We will be covering film, fashion, politics, literature, and comedy, as well as musicians. But right now, that's what I'm talking about. Everybody sing it!
So the swearing at the top of that clip, it came about because we thought if we're going to make a program about rule breakers, we should maybe break a rule or two ourselves. So that went out. That's Zane Lowe's show starts at 7 o'clock. It went out at 7 o'clock before the 9 o'clock watershed, proving that there's not very much that's funnier than an old lady swearing. Unfortunately, Ofcom disagreed. Fining us £250,000 for that, which shudder though I do to think of the terrible waste of licence payers' money. With the benefit of 10 years hindsight, does start to look like one of the most punk outcomes we could have hoped for. But that show really was celebrated as one of the more creative approaches to the sort of Reithian values of inform, educate, and entertain. It became a series, a sort of mini-series applied to other genres and other stations. So I'm running slightly over time, but I've only got one slide left, so hopefully you'll indulge me just for one last minute. So I just wanted to show you one more application of this process, I guess, just to sort of demonstrate that this way of thinking applies very much at the macro level as well as at the micro level. So after Radio 1, I went to MTV as head of music, looking after the UK's nine channels there, ranging from kind of MTV2 through MTV Base and up to VH1 Classic. And one of my biggest disappointments arriving at MTV was to discover that the kind of the programming techniques for video were pretty well identical to what they are for radio. So same ideas, same software, same people a lot of the time. And after a few years, I became convinced that there had to be a completely new kind of paradigm for programming music on a visual medium. So I sort of set myself this challenge of kind of radically reimagining the concept of music strategy for TV. So we did our insight gathering. And one of the main insights kept coming back was that people weren't so tribal about music as they once had been, certainly not as tribal as they were in the very early days of MTV, when these genre-based channels were set up. So there was no such thing as a kind of core MTV2 guy or an MTV-based girl, as we thought we knew them. And people actually were just using our channels more as mood enhancers than sort of badges of honour, as maybe they had before. So inspired by our rule-breaking friends at Johnson & Johnson, we thought, well, what if we just broke all of the rules of playlisting strategy? What if we just threw target demographics out the window altogether and started just focusing on the look and the feel of each video. And that became the inspiration for what became known as our look and feel programming strategy. So what you're seeing here is basically my music strategy for MTV in about 2009. So every channel was assigned a look descriptor and a feel descriptor. So, MTV Hits would look glossy and feel of the moment. MTV Dance would look sexy and feel up for it. VH1 would look accessible and feel heartfelt. We would, instead of just looking at whether, you know, let's say a new Rihanna video comes in, instead of asking whether Rihanna fits the target demographic of MTV Base or MTV Hits, we would say, does this specific piece of content fit the new brand values? If everything was filtered through these quite strict prisms, if you like. It made the decision-making process a lot more difficult. We had a lot of soul-searching to begin with, where we're saying, are we really going to stop putting Chemical Brothers on MTV Dance because their videos aren't sort of sexy enough? Maybe the Chemical Brothers have more of a home on MTV 2 now. And once we sort of got past that, the channels suddenly, almost overnight, had a much more distinct identity. Eventually, the ratings started going up as much as 50% in some cases. So you might think of this sort of mood-based approach to programming as a kind of precursor to this sort of context-based curation that works so well now for streaming services like Spotify. So that's it. It's just a very, very kind of whistle-stop tour of how insight-based creativity could work for you or your station or your streaming service. If you'd like to learn more, my website is newslangmedia.com. My name's Chris Price. I can often be found loitering around Twitter at Chris Pricey. Thanks for listening.